astrology or the Jewish attitude to astrology and related subjects. How are we supposed to understand it? What's our obligation? Are we allowed to be involved? Aren't we? Does it have any validity? How do we relate this? If you have any questions, then I'm happy to, if I can, to answer them. Let me tell you the basic approach to this subject from a spiritual point of view, and we'll try and understand. And the first thing to understand is this. Before we get to how we are supposed to relate to such a thing and why we're not allowed to be involved in it, that doesn't mean we're not allowed to believe that it's true and accurate. It may well be. In fact, it is. It is a power that's powerful and that can be accurate. But we are not allowed to put ourselves into that framework of thinking. But let's try and understand, first of all, what it is before we understand the halakhic side of what we're allowed or not allowed to do. So the basis of the subject is the following idea. Okay, and it's not so easy to grasp. Another way that we're used to thinking of, but this is the way to set up the concept so that we can understand all its applications and our obligations in it after that. So the mystical sources express an idea that's something like this. Now we could get a little carried away with this idea. Let's just try and say it's a very spiritual idea, and here we're talking about the higher world and all the interconnections. You can't just talk knowing that it was called astrology, right? So I don't have to apologize for that. But there are elements of it that are not easy to grasp. So let's try and see it like this. The famous Kabbalistic sources that talk about this put it something like this. They say that the world is made up of interlocking levels, each one higher than the next. There's an infinite number of these levels, but in the Kabbalistic writings you see that they are described as two levels, or three, or five, or 13, or 49, or just depending on what they're trying to bring into focus. But the basic idea is that there are spiritual worlds, each one a source of the next one. So I'm explaining. Again, you can't picture this with a picture. It's something that has to be understood in the spiritual abstract dimension. But if you like, there's a source of existence which is the highest world that's possible, which is what we call Hashem. Even that's not accurate, actually, because in the Kabbalistic writings it talks about worlds above the name that we use for Hashem. Levels that we don't have even a name for, most of which we're forbidden even to speak about. But let's just, for today's purposes of today, let's say this. We have a world which has a certain name. We relate to that name, to that world, with the name that we call Hashem, the Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei. Let's take it from there. And from that world down, there are many, many worlds, right? Specifically, in the most general form, there are four worlds. There's that world. Below that is what's called what the mystics call a diaphragm, like a muscle that separates the life-sustaining organs in the higher world from the bodily functions of the lower world. There's a world that's called Briah, that's the world of creation. There's a world called Yetzirah, that's the world of formation. And then there's a world called Asir, which is this physical, tangible world that we're in now. Let's look at it at that level for the meantime. So it comes out like this, that there are four levels. Again, that's just one way of looking at it. There's an infinite number of levels in each of these four. Actually, there's no end to it, but there are four discernible levels, the highest of which is completely transcendent, the total oneness. We can't know anything about it except that we're given a name that we can dive into, we can speak about, so it talks about. We can't understand anything within that. Even Moshe Rabbeinu, that world, if you like, on another system of 49 and 50 levels, it's the 50th level of transcendence. He himself wasn't able to get beyond the 49th. Nobody can get beyond that level while they're in the physical body, because if you go to that level, you aren't anymore. You're part of the infinite oneness. You can't grasp anything as an independent human being. You're in a level where you aren't anymore, but you blend into the source of existence. That's much harder to describe. Below that you have, let's say, three levels that we're talking about here. The first is the beginning of creation, what the mystics call Yesh Ma'an, something from nothing, the beginning of something. Then you have the world of formation, where that something starts to get formed. And then you have the world of what we call Asiyah, where it gels into shape in practical, tangible reality. That's this world here. Now, whichever way you divide them up and look at them, the concept that we have to understand is this. Each level is the cause and the center of existence of the world below it. Or if you like, it gives existence to the world below it. That world then gives existence to the world below that. That one gives to the one below it, and so forth and so on, as if it were a parent having a child, or the way the mystics talk, a husband giving to a wife. The wife then turns to the level below her, and she gives life to that level, and then that level to the one below it, etc. The mystics often say that each world is a male giving to a female, but then the female world is a male world giving to the next level, which is more female. Do you follow? And so forth and so on, until you get down to the ultimate female level, which is the world. And that's why this world is always described as female. All the objects, all the life-giving levels of this world, always, in Hebrew, the word Adama is female. But the word Eretz, which means the land, even though it's not a female word grammatically, but we always talk about it in the female, vessels that hold and sustain, the building blocks of reality, like the stones, those are all female words in Hebrew. And God is always described in the male. It's not because we're anti-feminist. It's because the source of the giving of a spark is what we define as male. And the receiving of the spark and giving life to that spark is what we define as female. That's what it is. So you have these infinite number of levels, each one giving to the next. And there's a lot that's written about them in the Kabbalistic writings, why it's that way, what it means to the level that we can understand and so forth. Now, let's not go into too much detail about that, although it's fascinating. But with that framework in mind, and of course each level has many features, there are angels in each level, what's called malachim, certain emanations or spiritual powers that are in each level, and they do certain things. And the angels in each level give to the ones below them, and each one takes instruction from the one above it, and the Rambam says can be massive, means he can grasp the essence of one above him, but not one above that, and so forth. And complicated system. Now, of all this system, there's one level that we have to focus on today, and that is what's called the astrological level, or the world of the stars, whatever that means. It's more really accurately the planets than the stars, but anyway, the world of the stars. Again, the trouble with this is if you start thinking about it in terms of the stars literally, so then you're on the wrong track. It's not the stars literally, the world, the astrological celestial world of the stars and planets we can see, certainly connected to this level, definitely. It wouldn't be named that way otherwise. And they manifest the forces that this level has. But they are not the spiritual agencies, they're physical bodies, just like the world. But vested in them is a connection. Is anyone still with me? Connection to the spiritual world. That's called the astrological level. Now, the definition of that level, and that's what we have to understand now, it's a remarkable subject. The definition of that level is that it's a connection between all higher levels and this world. Let's just try and understand. We have a concept that there's a spiritual world. Many worlds. Let's just call it the spiritual world for now. That's the intangible, abstract world. Then there's a practical world, the physical world that you can experience. Our tangible reality. Right? In me, my body, flesh. What's the connection between the two? How does the one give to the other? So there's a world that is not the spiritual world, but not yet the physical world. It's the world of interface. It's the world of connection between the spiritual world and this world. All energy that flows from the spiritual root into this physical world flows through that layer, which is called the astrological world, those cosmic forces. If you like, it would be, I mean, just to take a crude analogy with you, let's say you have a father and a mother, I don't know, or your parents and a child, but there's a seed somewhere in between. The seed contains all the energy, the totality of the parent's generation, manifests in the form of genes or whatever it is in the seed, and then when it comes down into the physical reality, it then grows into what it represents. Which means that if you can catch it at the point where it's a connection between the two, you can understand everything that's going to be. Because what you're looking at, if you could take the seed before it grows into an oak tree or a child, so then you're not looking at the parents' generation anymore, you're not going back into the root generation or the spiritual world, but on the other hand, you're not looking at the final thing. You're looking at the agent that carries the message from one world to the next. But the message obviously contains everything. If you know how to look in the seed, you knew how to look, and you can't look in the seed the way you look in the... When you cut open a seed, you don't find a little tree. You cut open an acorn, you don't find a little oak tree with little seeds. You have to know how to read it. It's coded there, but in a different way. You have to know how to read it chemically or whatever it is. Genetically, you've got to know how to read it. But if you know, and astrology is like that too, you can't look at it the same way you look at the world. You have to know how to look at it. But if you know how to look at it, you can see in this seed, for sure, this must be an oak tree. It can't be anything else. If you know about trees, you don't even know about seeds. But if you know about seeds, and you look at this seed, you know there's going to be an oak tree. You cannot know, say the mystics, exactly how to look. You can't see how many branches. It's all there. But they're built in inaccuracies that you can't read accurately enough. When the tree finally grows, you can see exactly how and what the branches are. So from the seed you can't see, but you can know the general information. And I'm saying this all for special reasons, because in the Kabbalistic system, the astrological forces are described as being those things that you can predict from, but inaccurately. That is, you can know a certain thing will happen, but you can't know exactly how, and it might make enormous difference in that you don't know exactly how it will play itself out. So be very cautious when you have an astrological prediction. Even if you trust the person that they know what they're saying, but there's a limit to what the human can say. Are you with me? You have to understand this is one of the first reasons why it's forbidden to be involved in it for anybody. Not only for Jews. For Jews specifically it's a terrible thing. For other much deeper reasons, which we'll try and discuss. But for anybody it's unwise, unless you know the parameters within which you're working. If you go to the seed to see how many leaves this tree is going to have, you're making a mistake. That's not the way to do it. Although it's there. It must be there, because it all flows through there. But if you go to the seed to know whether it's going to be an oak tree or a pine tree, that's okay. It's not allowed for us. We'll see why. But you have to know the limits of the system. That's the first principle. Let me just take, let's try and illustrate each principle as we go through it. Let's take an aside to give an example. You remember that Pharaoh in Egypt, they were tremendous astrologers, you know that. They were very, very potent in this skill. Pharaoh himself was a man who, he was pure intellect in this area. That is, so sensitive to this area. The Medrash says he was only about 2 or 3 tefachim high. That means Pharaoh himself was only about this high. He was only, as a man, that he was only tiny, right? Because the Medrash, what it means is that he was pure packaged spirit and intellect. He wasn't, you follow, it's not, the body was shrunken in it. There were very, very powerful emanations that they were able to generate. They, as you remember, the miracles that they performed, I mean, so Pharaoh saw, when Moshe Rabbeinu said to him that we Jews, we want to go out into the desert and serve Hashem and so forth, Pharaoh said to them, you're mistaken. I can see astrologically that you will come to disaster. I can see that you're going to have problems out there. And he was right. He didn't know what form it would take, right? But he knew that there was going to be a problem. He saw, he said, I see that there's blood. I see blood. He saw that the mystery created what exact stars he saw and how he put it together, and he saw that there'd be blood. He didn't know that it would be the blood of circumcision. He didn't know what blood it would be, the blood of the Pesach, the Korban Pesach and the circumcision. He didn't know that. In other words, what he saw turned out exactly the opposite. But he was 100% right about what he saw. I'll give you a simple example. It says, why did he have the Jewish baby thrown into the river? Why did he have the Jewish baby thrown into the Nile? He has cooked up a strange way of putting him out of action. No, astrologically he saw that the Jews would be, would have a terrible ordeal with water. He saw that there would be a distraction that would come about through, maybe remember what happened in the desert when there was the argument about the water and how what a terrible sin it was. He didn't know it. He saw a defeat, a negative event tapped into the Jewish people through water. So he thought that he'll activate it this way. But he was wrong about it. You follow? In other words, you have to know exactly, you have to know exactly how it's going to play itself out, and that you can't always know through the astrological system. That's its degree of inaccuracy in that way. Let's try and come back to that if we can. So what do we have? We have a principle that between any level and any other level, there's an intermediate level. Between the spiritual world in general and between this physical world that we can experience, there is a level which is half spiritual and half physical. It's half based in the abstract world and it's half based in the tangible world of the stars and the planets. Which means that if you want to read what's going to be, if you want to see what's going to happen when the forces project themselves down here, the highest you can get, unless you're a prophet, the highest you can, which we don't have today, the highest you can get is to look into the seed level. You can't see beyond that. To look into the seed level and see how the forces are set up there. And if you've done that, you know beforehand what's going to be. If you look into an oak seed carefully, years before the oak tree grows, you know what's going to be and you'll be 100% right about your prediction. The mystics say that actually you're not predicting the future, you're just reading the present. You're not predicting the future. The way that when we speak in Torah about predicting the future, what we mean is talking about things that are yet to be. That's called prophecy. Only a prophet, which we don't have today categorically, except for 3 rare exceptions, the Gemara says there's only 3 places now where you have prophecy. That's in dogs, children, and people who are not sane. There you still have some vestige of prophecy. But apart from that, you don't have prophecy as we knew it before. We don't have that now. Which means that to know what's going to be, we can't know. But to know the way that the way the energy is now, as it's about to be projected, you're not reading what's going to be, you're reading the way things are now. You're just reading them manifest in one plane. They haven't been manifest yet in the next plane. And I'll give you my own analogy, very crude as it is. Let's say somebody films a scene. And now the scene is now recorded on the film. Now they're going to take the film and they're going to project it on the screen so you can see it. Well, if you look at the film, you know, if you know how to look at the film, you know what's going to be projected. You're not reading the future, you're reading the present. Only it hasn't been manifest on the screen of this world yet. Are you with me? Not so hard to understand. And therefore, it's a skilled way of reading the present. You have to know how again. You have to know how it will project up and what it looks like. It might be a negative, black might be white, white might be black when it comes up. You have to know the rules. But if you know the rules, you can look now at the thing and see what's going to be. Now. This idea has got many fascinating applications in Jewish intolerance. Let's try and examine it. Let's start with the following idea. This is a very, very, very important idea. It's very hard for us to get in touch with because we don't really experience it today in this particular way. But let's try and stay together. We have a concept called idolatry. It's called Avodah Zara. Avodah Zara, that which means strange worship. That, idolatry, worshipping idols. The problem with this is like this. We're going to try and see that what it really means is relating to the astrological level or the intermediate level. So let's try and understand that. You see, we've got this primitive idea in our heads that people used to worship idols. They used to make a carved image out of a piece of wood, and then that was a god. I mean, if we're dealing with people, that's silly. That's not worth talking about. You follow, we're dealing with people of very strong spiritual, their spiritual sensitivity in earlier generations, much, much stronger than ours. You follow me? The Torah doesn't bother itself with idiots. Here's a man who takes a piece of wood, he carves it into a shape that he likes, and now he says that she's God, who created him and created the world and brings the rain and stuff. I mean, that's just stupid. That's not evil, it's silly. Are you with me? That's not what we understand to be idolatry. It doesn't make any sense at all. The Torah doesn't prohibit things that are stupid. Actually, things that are stupid are prohibited, but they're prohibited because they're stupid. You follow? They're not a prohibition because the Torah prohibits idolatry because of its enormous spiritual power and its enormous danger. The Torah doesn't do that about things that are just a figment of some idiot's imagination. Are you with me? So what we have to understand is, what exactly is this thing called idolatry that's so potent and so dangerous? Let me give you another aspect of this problem. There are many times, I don't know if it ever bothered you, but if you have any familiarity with Torah sources, even the davening in the Siddur, many, many times, to hit him, many times you'll see it says that it talks about other gods. Idolatrous relationship to other gods. Elohim Acherim, they're called, other gods. Right. And it says you're not allowed to worship other gods. And this concept, this name that we give to these gods, right, are the same names that we use for Hashem. When it says Elohim Acherim, when we say the word Elohim, meaning Hashem, we're not even allowed to say that word. When we use it with reference to idolatrous sources, we use the same word. Or in davening it says, Mi kamocha ba'elim Hashem. Who is like you, God, among all the gods? We use that word. But what's even more difficult is, did you ever think about those expressions? Imagine davening is saying like this, Hashem, you are great. This is what we say to our God. Hashem, you are great. Who is like you among all the gods? One second, what's going on? I thought they were figments of the imagination. Well, you follow? There are many, many verses and places in the davening where we talk about other gods. Now, we don't talk about things that don't exist. Yes, you follow? If it's just a figment of the imagination, it's just silly. So how can you go around saying? You follow? The Torah would say, don't be silly. Worship me. Don't imagine that there's anything else. But the Torah doesn't do that. The Torah says you must work and worship and relate to me, and don't worship and don't relate to other gods, which means acknowledging that they are. I mean, you don't have to worship about it. Are you with me? Otherwise, how could you stand up and say, Hashem, who's like you among all the gods? So the way it's translated in English, if you read it, this is, who's like you among the mighty ones? Or the powerful ones or something. So you imagine it means, so who does it mean exactly? I want to understand, who does it mean? The kings of the nations. What a stupid comment. God, who's like you among the human kings? I mean, that's silly. Not even, you're not comparing like and like. Can you hear the problem? You know, think about this. But the answer is as follows. It's a frightening and amazing idea. There certainly are. What you're prohibited from worshipping is definite sources of power, correct spiritual sources of power. They definitely exist. The Torah is not warning you against figments of the imagination. The Torah is prohibiting you from relating to certain sources that actually are. And they are in that level of transcendent spirituality, and those names are fitting for them. And the funny thing about it is they're very close to the real source. In fact, they're so close, they're perfectly in line with the real source. And that's what you're not allowed to relate to. Let's try and understand. Let's approach it this way. I think it'll be clear. Difficult subject to talk about. Let's try and understand. The Rambam puts it this way. The Rambam says like this. This is the most beautiful way to understand. The Rambam says, how did this practice of idolatrous worship arise in the world? You know, the world started with perfect spiritual knowledge. Adam HaRishon didn't have a problem with worshipping, you know, he spoke to Hashem face to face. When Noah came out of the ark with his sons, they knew exactly where the spiritual source was. Right? And through the generations while there was prophecy, certainly people saw where the source was. When did it arise? How did it arise among certain nations that they started deviating and worshipping or relating to sources that were unkosher? The Rambam says this is what happened. Listen to this incredible thing. See that when you understand this, you'll see that the immaturity of what we thought before, is just embarrassing. Can you see Hashem getting upset because some human wants to bow down to a little carving that he made in a piece of wood? I mean, that's pity on a person, I guess. So the Rambam says the following thing. What happened was this. People of primitive wisdom, in the great days of great spiritual power, they knew what the source was. And then they said to themselves the following thing. This level, this source that we relate to, which is the creator of the world, how does he manifest in our world? He manifests through intermediaries. Everything he does is through intermediaries. He doesn't appear to us directly. He manipulates nature, right? He appears in the wind, in fire, in the rain, in the forces of nature. Every force of nature is an emanation of his power. The sun, for example, that was one of the first that Rambam said. The sun is an emanation of his power. The sun, incredible source of life. He pours through the sun the energy into the world. When he wants to give you warmth and life and chesed and everything that he wants to do, he pours it into an agent called the sun. It's a very, very definite intermediary. Is that correct? Hashem doesn't warm you himself. You don't feel him or see him. You feel the sun's rays, and that's what makes everything go around you and the world flourish and so forth. That's the way he chooses to do it. So these early people, they said the following thing. Hashem is so great that all the agents that he uses are emanations of his being, and it's fitting to worship them as representatives of him. The Rambam says it's like if a king sends you one, he's honored. If a king wants to send you a messenger, he sends his prime minister to your house. He's most honored minister in his thing. So wouldn't you honor the minister? By honoring this official of his government, you're honoring the king. And if you slight him, you're slighting the king. And that's the way it goes in these protocols of, the way things are handled in royalty and diplomatic circles. That's the way it goes. So if Hashem creates a world of intermediaries, shouldn't we appreciate it? Shouldn't we relate to these things as having the greatness of being emanations of his power? Shouldn't we appreciate what the sun is as an emanation in intermediary? We can't see him. We can't see beyond that. But at least the level we can see. In other words, what they were saying was this. Are you with me? What they were saying was this. Hashem is in the highest world. He emanates down to the next world, and to the next world, and the next. But the final emanation is the end of a pipeline, and out of that pipeline pours down to us what we can actually see and experience. We can't see beyond the mouth of the pipeline. We can't see what's inside where it's coming from. But at least the opening, at least let's get close to that. The closest we can get to, let's get close to where the energy pours out, and let's show it honor. So they started showing honor to the forces of nature as appreciation of their being emanations of Hashem, and it was perfectly kosher. Because they weren't divorcing it from Hashem, on the contrary, they were showing him more honor. They were relating to him through the closest they could get. It's a little bit, if you like, when Moshe Rabbeinu went up the mountain, he told me Joshua, he went with him until the point where no human was allowed to go. And he waited there, and Moshe Rabbeinu went up the mountain. And for 40 days he camped there. Why did he camp there? Wanted to go home to his family for 40 days. He knew his ready was going to be 40 days away. No, he stayed as close as he could. You follow? He stayed at that place. He waited there, he didn't go back. He wanted to be the closest point that he could. So let's go as close as we can. Let's go to the sun and the wind and the rain and the stars and everything that's an emanation of his energy that flows down to them. And then the Rambam says, after a while, they forgot about the source. After a while of relating to these things, where it was tangible and much easier, and you could actually feel it and see it and experience it, then gradually, they started thinking that the source is so distant, and how can you really relate to it? And the one thing over the generations became the other. So finally, what happened was, they related to where they saw the energy flowing out. That's what it is. That is idolatry. So you hear this? Idolatry is not relating to something out of the system. You have here Hashem pouring his energy down through the spiritual world, finally through the astrological world, into the world of nature and the forces and energies of nature, and finally into your world. That's the axis. He's not talking about going out of the axis and making up some figment of your imagination. The Torah hasn't got time to talk. Then the Torah would have to speak about everybody's stupidity. This person's silliness and that one's imagine what you could cook up as being false. the fellow that's coming next to you, all of them. Obviously, we're not talking about that. We're talking about people who are in the action, and they are relating to the source, and they write about it. And they're not fools. They are feeling the spiritual power. And they're feeling the correct spiritual power from the correct source. You hear what's going on here? The only error is that they're feeling the source as being, they mistake the final end of the channel that they can feel for being the original source. They just not, that's the only thing they're leaving out. They're very, very close to the truth. That's its problem. That's its issue. Because as close as you are, you just forgot about Hashem. So now you're living in a world that's causes of nature and things like, you know, the sun does this and the rain does that, and you just forgot about me. You know, I'm handing out this stuff to you, fellow. How would a father feel if he every day comes past his son's house and in the post box he puts a lot of money? And after a few weeks, the son starts writing letters to the mailbox, thanking him for the money. I mean, you understand? You've got to realize it's just a channel where the things manifest, but you've got to go to the source all the time. Obviously. Now, well, he says it with an agent, let's say, and the child forgets where it's coming from. Now, let's just take a look one step deeper. Are you still with me? Let's take a look one step deeper, just to understand this, how it works in the neshama. What does it mean they forgot? It doesn't mean they forgot, they started looking at where the energy comes from and they forgot about the source. Let's understand it. I heard from a very great man who never admits to any Kabbalistic knowledge, no matter how much I try, never admits to, he won't talk about it. But he said this. He always puts it in a way, you know, that the 6-year-old could understand. That's one day when I get a bit more sophisticated, he'll speak to me. Well, deeper, but this is the way he put it to me. He said to me, you know what idolatry is? You know what Avodah Zarah is? You know, he's 90s already, very, very great man, inshallah. He said to me, you know what Avodah Zarah is? You know what idolatry is? Listen to this. This is the way he put it. It's just good enough for a 6-year-old. You know what idolatry is? Idolatry is not bowing down to a piece of wood. By the way, you must understand that these carvings that they make are representations of the forces in nature. They do make carvings, right? They make graven images. What are these things? What are these things that these primitive peoples or whoever it is that they did or that they do make? They do make images. But they're just tangible representations of a force in nature that's abstract. It's either a sun god or a rain god or fertility or something. You follow? It's a valid source of power. They don't attribute the power to this piece of wood. They might give this piece of wood honor just like we give a Sefer Torah honor. $5 because it's an emanation and representation of Hashem. But it's not the thing itself. Obviously, he's relating to the source. He just made something to remind him or that he can relate to. And through this, he's relating to or worshipping this. You follow? If he's gone so far that he really worships a piece of wood, as an end of itself, I don't bother with him. Okay. Now, he put it like this. He said, idolatry is a person, listen to this, amazing thing. He said, it's exactly the following thing. It's a person who goes into a shop, a department store, and he wants to buy a camera. He sees behind the counter there's a camera there that costs $1,500, let's say. But he's only got $150. So he calls over the assistant behind the counter and he says, listen, I'll flip you $150, you pass me the camera. So the chap then takes the brass and he gives him the camera and he walks out for the camera. What's the problem? The problem is somebody owns the store. You know, there's somebody losing out over here. There's a person who owns the department store who's supposed, you know, who's losing out over here. But the chap behind the counter, he doesn't care about that. And the man buying the camera, he doesn't care who owns this. He just wants to, he's interested in the man who can deliver the goods. You know, he said who owns the whole business. He's interested in speaking to the person who can deliver the goods. Are you with me? So he goes, he wants a camera, he'll go to the man who can deliver the camera. He wants something else, he'll go to that department, he'll speak to the man behind the counter, can deliver the goods over there. And he'll pay him enough to make him happy and deliver the goods. The overall system of what's right and wrong and who's the boss of this whole thing is irrelevant to him. In other words, a person who's involved in Avodah Zarah, he's interested in the rain, or the sun, or fertility, or war, or whatever it is, because that's where the goods are delivered. He doesn't care who runs the whole show, it doesn't bother him. It's not relevant to him, you follow? Who runs the overall department store? The ultimate creator, doesn't bother him at all. It's got nothing to do with me. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in fertility or rain or wealth or brocha or whatever it is, children. So I go to the department. It all comes through agencies. It's broken down into, no question, it's broken into departments. The astrological world is a world of departments. That's what it is. There's this agency and this agency and this constellation of forces and that cosmic arrangement. So I'll go to the source where this energy is available and I'll pay him off. I won't pay the real price. The real price you have to pay yourself. When you serve Hashem, you have to give yourself. Can't make up a thing the way you want it, you know, it's a full price. You don't want the camera, pay the full price of the camera. You follow me? So I'm not interested in being, I'm not going to sell myself to him. I'll give away something very valuable. I'll give away part of myself to the person behind the counter who handles that. You follow what's going on? And if you examine it, you'll see it's exactly true. The example he gave me was, but you see it everywhere, is that if you look at the Greek system, you remember the Greeks had a pantheon of all kind of gods. You remember that? the Greeks, the god of this, the god of that, the god of that. Do they have one who created the world?
No.
On this mountain that they have, where all these gods hang out, they've got ones that will take care of anything you need. But one who owns the whole business and created the whole thing in the beginning, no. So what are they needing for? You follow? This is irrelevant. What do you need to speak to him about? You follow?
Yeah.
But isn't that a simplification? Because there are some people who made Judaism worshipping like idols who are really searching for spiritual truth.
I'm not saying people are sincere. Let me finish the picture, okay? Hold your question. Do you mind? Let me just finish this. Now, so the motivation, the reason they forgot the source, let's call it that, and started relating to the channels that are tangible sources of each thing that you need, is because that's the vested interest. This is they forgot about it historically, but because they're not important. Right? What's important to me is where I can get, who can deliver the goods, and therefore they started relating to it. And that's what it was. So the definition of idolatry, what a Jew is not allowed to do, what no human is allowed to do, is to take the system, which is a system where we don't see directly the source comes to us through intermediaries in many different ways, and to relate to the intermediary as if that's the source. Now, and of course, there's very deep mystical things here, that's why these other gods are called Elohim Acherim. Elohim Acherim, literally translated, means other gods, but the mystics read it as Elohim Achorayim, which means the backside of the gods. It means the backside, the side of blindness and excretion. Do you know what idolatry is called in Gilulim? Gilulim means balls of dung, excrement, that's what it's called. Why? Because it's a system that's correct. What is excrement, excuse me? It's pure food, right? When the goodness has been extracted and the waste product remains, that's what stinks. So the system, they're quite right about it, is a part of reality. Wastage and excrement is a part of reality, and it's a needed part of reality. But you're a fool if you grab onto that. That's what you excrete out. The fact that this intermediary system that isn't the source, that's what a person has to exclude from his consciousness. He has to realize it's a manifestation and see the source in that. But a fool who forgets the source and relates to this, so he's taken the food, thrown the food away, and kept what smells. Do you follow? That's why it's called gods of the back, as opposed to the front. You follow? Not the fertile, beautiful side, but the side of... That's what it is. That's what it is. There's amazing things in the Sukkim. It says that... in Sukkim it says that finally, the final act that Hashem will do is that he will... What can he say? It says, Ani esbova amalek. Amalek means I will spew out. When the final revelation happens, Hashem says in Pasuk that when I have to reveal myself to you, what I will do, and it's described as laughter. It's a very interesting thing anyway. I will reveal myself, Ani esbova amalek. I will... What can I say? Spit out. I will spew out, excrete all negativity. That means evil will be shown to be, all the whole world of illusion that we're talking about will be shown to be exactly that. Today it's all mixed in, but it will all be dissociated out. That's what it will be. That's a long subject in the summer. Okay, now. So what do we have? We have here the following thing. We're not talking about nonsense that doesn't exist. We're talking about forces that come down through the channel. Then there's a final level that we can actually see it and relate to it. Now, if a person goes to that level, that open pipeline or that agency in nature or the cosmic arrangement or whatever it is, so if you see over there, one, you're right, it is coming from there, absolutely right, it is coming from there, just the stars much higher, but it's coming from there. Two, you can read what's coming out, because it's coming from there. You're not looking at something disconnected, you are looking at, except you're looking at the channel flowing out before it's actually reached down here. But if you look at it there, you'll see the way it's going to flow out. You don't know how it will organize itself exactly before it gets here, but you can know a lot about it. That is what we call the world of astrological influences. The level of why it's the stars and so on, I'm not going to go into now. But they are an indication of how the energy comes up. And if you relate to that level, so it is coming through there, they're correct about it, and you can read certain things. Now, that's more or less an introduction to an understanding of what is this, where is this thing, what is it that we talk about when we mean the idolatrous side of the spiritual world, or the application of astrological or other spiritualist or spiritual type of forces. There are different versions of this same application that were just today was suggested, speaking about astrology. This has to be applied to many other systems of spirituality. Spiritualism, by the way, contacting the shamans of people who are not alive anymore, is a very similar discussion, also not allowed. For other reasons also, in addition to the same reasons. If we get time, we can talk about that also. And let's just stick to, just try and build at least one theme that we can understand well. Now, let's understand how we're supposed to relate to this. Like, why is it a problem? So we've understood already one level why it's a problem, because instead of relating to the source, you're relating to that level. Now, let's go deeper. You still together with me? Let's go deeper now. Listen carefully now. The definition of a Jew is that he's a person, or she is a person who relates to the inner world and not the outer world. Again, what we are supposed to be here in the world, we are supposed to be people who relate to the inner world and not the outer world. A Jew's obligation is when you see a human being, if you look at the body that he walks around in and you stop there, you're not behaving like a Jew. Of course you need the body, and of course it's beautiful, and you can't have a marriage or a friendship or children without that body, but if you relate only to the body, so then you're not being Jewish. Be like an animal. The obligation of a Jew is to see through the body into the person that's inside. The person inside you can never see directly. You can't see them directly. The only way you can ever see the person inside is by seeing what the body does and says and how it moves. But that's not what you're interested in. A Jew has to develop a talent of looking at the outer world and perceiving what the inner world is. Women, by the way, it says have a natural talent at this. Men have a block about this. Men look at the outer world and they get stuck there. That's the problem. Man has to make a conscious effort to train himself all the time to see the inner world. Women have a talent for looking at the outer world and connecting it spiritually into the inner world, what it means. That's why it says women have got such accurate sensitivity about personalities, and that's why men are supposed to listen to their wives about their assessment of people's personalities and whom to associate with and so forth. But that's what a person's supposed to train himself in doing. That you're supposed to look at the outer world and not avoid the outer world. The only way you can read anything is by looking at the outer world. You can't have a friend without his having a body to present himself to you, or a husband or a wife or a child. But not to stop there. To see it only as a vehicle, and that's all. When you smile. So the face that's smiling is just a way of showing you. It's the intermediate level, that's all it is. It's the channel that shows you who he is inside that you could never see in this world. Are you with me? That's the obligation of a Jew. In the broad sense, the obligation of a Jew is not to relate to the channels, but to relate to the source behind the channels that you can't ever see directly. To never forget that the forces are coming down to you as an organization, an outpouring of the energy that represents the source. But don't get connected, don't get stuck. Yes? If you get stuck, it's like a person who lives in his friend's body. He's tapping and, you know, involved in his friend's body all the time. What an insult to the person inside. Well, a woman would be insulted if a man only takes notice of the external reality. Women are very insulted about that. Beautiful as it may be, but it's an insult. What you're interested in is that you should be loved and understood for what's inside, what you really are, the essence. And then you understand the beauty of the body, because you see how it's a beautiful expression of the essence inside and the two are perfectly matched. But if you cut off the inside... Okay, now, non-Jews have got a different pathway here. I'm not going to get into that now. A beautiful spiritual pathway also, but it's not... We're talking now specifically today about Jewish obligations. Therefore, that is why astrology and astrological predictions and getting involved in it is forbidden. Because what you're doing is you're reading an accurate thing. I'm not talking about charlatans who are pretending to know. Obviously, we're not talking about that. We're talking about people who are accredited, who've been proven to be correct. There are not many of them left. The people who do have some ability, let's say, if you could find. Then such people to get involved with such things. For a Jew even to go to such a person is forbidden. Because, not because it's inaccurate and foolish. On the contrary, because it's correct. Because it's correct. If you go there, you're not here as a Jew, you have an opportunity and an obligation to speak to the boss. So go direct to the source. What are you messing around because you feel inadequate, or you feel you can't measure up, or you feel you can't generate what it takes to speak to the source? So you're dealing with the... Now, let's go further. Let's go further. This is the pricing book. The spiritual world is set up in a way. Okay, if you want to remember practically, or you know people who are involved in certain kind of spiritualism or astrology or whatever, then this is the part you have to remember. Careful how you put it across, but this is what you have to remember. The spiritual world is built in such a way that it responds to you the way you relate to it. That's the rule. Always like that and only like that. The way you relate to the spiritual world, that's the way it relates to you. Many reasons, long discussion in this other round. The application in this format that we're talking today is as follows. Listen well. If you relate to the astrological forces, they become binding upon you. If you relate, if you go to an astrologer, and you put yourself into that system, and this person knows what he's doing, and he says, I can see that in 6 months' time, this and this is going to happen to you, and you put yourself into that, you approach him or her, and you understand it to be for what it is, you now become bound by that, and you can't escape. You can't escape. In other words, you hear the paradox. You've now put yourself into a situation of knowing something that's to be, you put yourself into that spiritual connection, and now you can't get out of it. Had you not gone, it wouldn't have applied to you. Even though the forces were that way. Let's understand carefully. Let's put ourselves into a scene. Here are certain astrological forces. They point at a certain individual, and they say that in 6 months' time, this and this is going to happen to that person. Okay? They say it accurately. When you read it, you can't read it accurately exactly how it's going to manifest. Who in the family will be involved necessarily, or in which way, let's say. But it will be manifest in a certain way. Now, that person doesn't know about it. And yet it's true. What happens? It may not apply. Ah, it says so? No, it may not apply anyway, despite the fact that it says so. When what finally happens, happens, you then realize that you just didn't know how to read it. In other words, of course, the seed can only produce the tree that it has contained within it. But you can, when you look at the seed, there are different ways to see what's going to be. So it could, you follow. Let me give you an example, okay? Let me give you an example. It says that when Hannah went to daven for a child, she was childless, okay? She was terribly, terribly distraught about it. She went to the Beis HaMikdash, to the Mishkan, to daven for a child. So she prayed and prayed and prayed. She davened and davened for a child. When Eli, the priest, the Kohen, saw her, he thought she was drunk. He saw a woman mouthing words, right? We learn from Hannah that you daven silently by moving your lips and you should hear but nobody else. He saw this woman, he thought she was drunk. So he chastised her and she said, I'm not drunk. And she explained the situation and he gave her a bracha and she had a child who was Samuel Shmuel. So the Midrash, the Chazal say, why did he think she was drunk? Listen to this. Why did he think she was drunk? It's an incredible thing. Because when he saw this woman, he didn't make a rash decision. He didn't jump to decisions. He saw a woman who was drunk. But he was a very great man. And you're not allowed to come into the Mishkan drunk. You can't come into the holy place like that not being in control. But he didn't make a snap judgment. He went to the Urim Batumim. Do you remember the Kohen Gadol had on his chest the breastplate of the 12 stones? Remember that? And it was a mystical, amazing gift from Hashem that he was able to foretell or perceive things that the human eye couldn't see by looking at this. Because the stones would light up in the shape of letters. The stones used to light up. That's why they would go to the Kohen Gadol. When they needed some prophetic prediction, they would go to him. The stones would light up in letters and he would read the letters and tell you what the prediction was. When he saw this woman, before chastising her, he went to the Urim Batumim and it spelled out the word Shikora, a drunk woman. It spelled her out. So what is he supposed to do? So he went up to her and he said to her, listen, you can't come in here drunk and so on. And she turned out not to be drunk. She said, I'm not drunk. And she was a very kosher spiritual woman. She was completely a kosher woman, like anything. So what happened to what he read on the breastplate? So he went back and he saw again. He got the letters wrong. It's not Shikora, it's Kesera, a kosher woman. He's read the letters in the wrong order. You follow? On Wednesday morning, she doesn't jump up and down on his arm. He just cries, right? Am I not explaining it properly? Are you with me? In other words, you have to know how to read it. All the signs are there. It's exactly the way it's supposed to be. The problem is you. The problem is you. The forces astrologically could say a certain thing. You have to know which way it's going to be, definitely. There's so many examples in Egypt that says, an open prediction in the Torah that you'll be there for 400 years. The Jews were saved after 210. He had a prediction from God that it would be for 400. God, Hashem never says anything that's not accurate. You didn't know when to calculate from. You thought you'd start calculating from now, that is 210. No, Hashem revealed that you calculate from the birth of Yitzchak. Who told you when to start figuring from? You follow? The information's all there and it's accurate. But only after it's happened can you be sure which way it's going to play itself out. By the way, I heard from my rabbi recently, it's one of the greatest evils of this generation is people who think they know how things are going to be. It's an axiom of Torah that you can't know how things are going to be. Even if you have a prediction, a prophecy, you can't know how it's going to be. Because you don't know how the mix of factors is going to express itself. We just know the general principle. We know the Torah of the thing. We know the elements and how it's supposed to be according to Torah. But what will be in practice, how it will look, we've no idea. Are you with me? Okay, now. That's the way it is. So the prediction in the astrological world of how it's going to be, the factors are there, and if you read them in the most obvious way, it would seem to be a certain thing. It might be, for example, very bad. But the point is that Hashem can manifest that in any way he wants to. It could be Shikora or Keshera. You don't know how it's going to be. So if you don't know, and you have Emunah, and you relate to Hashem directly, he'll arrange it that it will come out correct, the way it has to be. Right? Well, for what you need, for what you best need. And if you can relate to the source, you'll do it according to the source, which is the highest level of kindness. But if you don't relate to the source, if you relate to the way you read it, you've frozen it now, that's why. He can't change it now. He can't change it now because he relates to you only the way you relate to him. You look up at him and say, child since you were born. You were born. How was the Jewish people born? From Isaac, from Yitzchak, who was born from Abraham and Sarah, couldn't have children. Let's understand. Let's try and understand this final principle. The principle is this. There's an astrological world that's accurate, it's true, it's valid, it has power. The obligation of the Jews to transcend it and relate to the source, and when you do that, you suddenly dissolve the whole astrological world, and it doesn't relate to you anymore. It suddenly gets reinterpreted that you now understand what it really meant, okay, totally different from what it would have looked like from the bottom. That's the Jewish obligation. Do that, that's what happens. Don't do that, you become subservient to the forces, you're a little cog in a mechanical system and you can't get out of it. Tragedy, too bad. Can't get out of it. Relate to the source, doesn't have to be any tragedy. Let's understand. Why did this happen like this? Why is it like this? says the following. The first Jew in the world, the first person represented his value was Abraham Avinu. So Avraham Avinu, by the way, this is the evil of systems of Judaism that are not Torah. Yes? People who, I don't even want to credit them with the names of, but people who, let's say, reform certain things, or tell you that they're conserving certain things, but they're not conserving. Ah, whatever they want to call themselves, they're not Judaism at all. The problem is that what they do is they take a spiritual transcendent system and they're trying to apply some sort of natural order to it. That's exactly the opposite of Torah. Torah is only relating to a transcendent mystical world. That's what it is. Soon as you slot it into something that's a bit more natural, a bit more normal, a bit more acceptable, a bit that fits with me better, you follow. Any of that kind of change where I get into the picture, so then that's exactly what the system's worth, how much you're worth. You follow? Apologetics or half measures. We relate directly to the mystical transcendent source. It's that or nothing. It's that or death. So this man Abraham, he fitted into a natural system. The natural system was the world. He didn't see Hashem. God hadn't manifested to him. He saw the physical world. He looked at the physical world and he said, you know, I think there's something going on here beneath the surface. This is the external world. I think there's something going on inside, because this world hints to me, suggests to me that it has an incredible theme running through it, like a signature that signifies unity and depth and kindness. And as soon as he realized that, and the Medrash says he was 3 years old, by the way. He was 3 years old. Anyway. As soon as he said that, Hashem said, yes, you're right, it's me, and he appeared to him. And then he had a proof and a revelation from the higher world. And he did it again when he was 48 and when he was 75, different levels. Now, so that's what he was. What was he? Again, he was a man who saw the natural world and refused to believe that it was natural, broke through the surface, cracked through the surface, and saw the spiritual core. Refused to relate to the pipeline, the channel where the energy comes out, insisted on relating to the source, was prepared to give his life for it, was thrown into the furnace for it, and when he was prepared to give his life for it, Hashem appeared to him and says, yes, you're right, here I am. And from then on, he was handled in a completely transcendent way. What was the result? The result was this. One day, Hashem came to him and said, you are now going to have a son. You remember? You will have a son. So Avraham Avinu said, but Hashem, I'm sorry to argue with you, but I see it's impossible. I see in the stars, he was an astrologer, I see in the stars that I can't have a son. A son, S-O-N, yes, yes. It's written clearly in the stars that I can't have a children. Avraham and Moynik. Abraham will never have a son. It says so in the stars. I can read the stars. Now, let's understand what's going on. He wasn't arguing with God. You know, if Hashem appeared to you and said, you're going to have a son in a year, you start saying, yeah, but Hashem, but my astrologer says no. Then what are you going to... He wasn't... But obviously, the idea was this. When Hashem said to him, you're going to have a son, he said, Hashem, I see in the stars... And who wrote the stars? You. Hashem, you're telling me here that I'm going to have a son. But it's your world, and I've learned how to read your world, and I can see the source of the forces in your world, the way they manifest. If you give me a son, surely you're going to do it by making my body function through the level. How do you do anything in the world? You send out the spiritual energy, it goes through the astrological level, like I explained in the beginning, that's the intermediate stage, and then it manifests in me. So how's it going to get to me if not through the system? And I can see the system says I'll never have a son. I'm not arguing with you, that's what you say. So it says, Vayetze oitzo achutza, Hashem took him outside, and he showed him the stars. So the child, the six-year-old child, understanding is this, Hashem took him out of his tent, and he showed him the stars. And he said, you see how numerous these stars are? You'll have sons like that. That will be the Jewish people, will be your children. So the verse, the simple meaning of the verse is he took him outside. But the Kabbalistic meaning of the verse is he took him outside the world. He took him outside the stars. The Kabbalists say, he took him completely outside, and he said, you think you're subject to that? You think you're part of the system? You're not part of the system. You're part of the source. You're not subject to those rules. What are you looking at the stars for? Why did he do that? Why did Abraham deserve to have that done to him? I told you, the spiritual world only relates to you the way you relate to it. Hashem doesn't come and shape a man out of the system and take him into the spiritual world and make him that powerful for no reason. You know why? Because Abraham did that himself. He refused to accept, when he was 3 years old, he refused to accept the rules of the physical world. He said, I see that all these rules, I refuse to accept them. I believe there's something deeper that you can't see. He refused to accept the rules. He refused to accept nature. When Hashem saw that, he was prepared to do that. He said, yes, here I am. He showed himself to him. So later, when the natural world again said that this and this will be the consequence, Hashem said, now I'll do it for you. And he slept him outside. He said, you know, you follow. He deserved it. He was a person who so changed himself, who so insisted on relating to the source and not the tangible agencies, but on relating to the source that transcends the agencies, that Hashem paid it out in kind. And he took him out of the system and he said, you don't belong there. From that time on, the Jewish people who were born out of him were a people who were born in transcendence. Every step of the way, we are people who live in the mystical transcendent world. We just aren't subject to the rules. How was Isaac born? How was Yitzhak born? Who was this child who was born? How was he born? Yes, that God predicted. Yitzchak, how was he born? Abraham was 100 years old. He was too old to have children, it says. Sarah was 90 or 99. She was too old. Not only was she too old to have children, she didn't have a womb, it says. She didn't have the organs of childbirth. The Kumash says, Enla vlad. The Kumash says, Enla beis vlad. She had no... She couldn't have a child. She was completely barren. She couldn't possibly have a child. So the Malachim arrived and they said, yes, you'll have a child in a year. So they both laughed. They didn't laugh in disbelief. They laughed with the joy of being transported into the spiritual world. It says they laughed with the happiness of holding the child in their arms now. And what happened? Isaac was born. Do you follow? He was born from a man who was too old, from a woman who was too old, from a woman who was completely infertile. We begin where despair ends.
Did she have a pregnancy?
Yes. Yes, she was pregnant. She became pregnant. We begin where the impossible ends. That is the Jewish people. And that's what Yitzchak means. He will laugh. Because it's incredible, but that's real laughter. Laughter is when impossible... That's what laughter is. Laughter is when two impossible things are put together. You burst out laughing, even if it's not funny. That is Yitzchak. And then what happens to this man? Just to prove it, when he's 36 years old, his father sacrifices him on the altar. You know, in the spiritual world, it says he was actually sacrificed. It says the ashes of Yitzchak are always in front of me. He gets sacrificed by his father on the altar. What's the next thing he does when he gets off the altar? He has children. He doesn't get married. He marries Rivka and has children. The Jewish people begin after death. Do you follow? We begin in the next world. We've got nothing to do with this world. Are you? That's what we... let me just finish the... Hold it a second. That's what we are. That's what we're here for. As soon as a Jew puts himself into the natural system and starts looking at natural forces or things that sound logical in the natural world or reading energies and forces and cosmic... He's being exact, not because it's not true. Not because it's foolish. On the contrary, it's true as anything. But the point is, you're supposed to go beyond that. That's not where you belong. And if you refuse to go beyond it, and if you put yourself in here, then you become part of the system. You only get the way you pay. And therefore, the purpose of a Jew is to live in a transcendent fashion. If you live in a transcendent fashion and you live in that world, then that's the world that takes care of you. You follow? The Gemara says it like this. Listen carefully. How do you reach a transcendent world? How do you... So you live in a transcendent world. What do you do? Mitzvahs, right? You keep the Torah. You do the mitzvahs. What are mitzvahs? Mitzvahs are physical activities. Almost all the mitzvahs are done with the body. You know that. There's a handful of mitzvahs, literally, that are done with the mind. Loving Hashem, fear of Hashem, remembering certain things. But apart from that, almost all the mitzvahs are done with the body. Isn't that amazing? If you ask me to design a spiritual system where I design something where you go and meditate and you do all kind of things, I wouldn't design, but it isn't. The Torah isn't like that. Of 613 mitzvahs, almost all are done with the mind. You dip this with your hand and eat matzah with your mouth and sit in a circle with your body. You got to get your body into a mikveh if you're a woman. You have to, right? It's all done with the body. Why? Because the point of Judaism, the point of Torah, is that you take the external world and you push it through to the... It's exactly that. We don't look at spiritual things. We take the physical world and connect it to the source all the time. You connect your hand to the spiritual world with this mitzvah. Your body, the lowest part of your body, to the spiritual world by that mitzvah. Do you follow me? Your mouth, every part of your body and the totality of your body, you take the physical reality and you show that it's not physical. You connect it up to the energy, to the source. That's what you do. And therefore, if a Jew does a mitzvah, if a Jew goes to astrology, what happens is you become subject to those forces, and whatever they say is you. And you can't get out of it because you built it. If you refuse to go to that system, you take the physical world instead of reading the way it seems to you, and you push it to its source, and you speak to Hashem directly, the whole system crumbles, and it's got nothing to do with you, and you relate it to the way you relate to it. The Gemara puts it like this. I'll make it tangible. The Gemara says there was an astrologer who saw the daughter of Rabbi Akiva. Listen to this. So he looked in the constellations and he said that it's written clearly she will die on her wedding day. Definitely. It's written, that's clear. The day she gets married, that's the day she'll die. And we're not talking about fools, we're talking about somebody who knew exactly what was going to be. On the day of her wedding, she sat at the Suda, she was sitting at the wedding feast, and you know they had long hairpins. She took a hairpin out of her hair, and she stuck it in the wall behind her, and it transfixed the cobra that was about to bite her. So they said to her, that's amazing. What happened today? You must have done something special to be saved in such a miraculous fashion, that your life was saved in such an incredible... So she said, no, got married. So they went through, and it turned out that while she was sitting at the meal, she suddenly became aware that there were people in the street who were hungry. So she took part of her wedding suda, and when no one noticed, she went outside and she gave them food. Saved her life. That's why. She did something unnatural. She did a mitzvah activity. Wait, you follow? What bride is thinking about that? She's thinking about her dress. I don't know. About her husband. She thought about somebody else who had a need. That's a transcendent activity. That's lifting yourself to a level of spirituality. You do that, the spiritual world is what takes over. Do you follow? The Gemara says that there were two men standing watching a group of woodcutters. And one of them was an astrologer. And he said to his friend, I see that one of these men is not going to come back today. He didn't know which one exactly, as often the prediction is like that, but one of them for sure, unfortunately, not going to survive today. So they waited, there's nothing they could do. They waited till the end of the day and all the men came back. So they went over to the group and they said to the men, he couldn't believe it because he knew clearly at the start said that one of them, they were Jews, that one of them wouldn't survive. So they went over to the men and they said, what happened in the forest today? So the men said, no, the only unusual thing was that our friend over here, as he chopped a log, he cut in half a snake that was poised to bite him. It's always a snake, by the way, for certain reasons, I'm not going to... But anyway, that's what happened. So they went over to this man and they said to him, you had a very lucky escape today. What happened? So he said, no, nothing. So they went through the day carefully and it turned out that when they were sitting around at lunchtime, there was a worker who didn't bring any lunch and this man gave him his. Saved his life. You follow? A hungry worker, he overcame the natural, the natural doesn't exist for you. That's what a Jew is, that's what we're supposed to be tuned to. Are you with me, school? Let's just sum up like this. That the forces that come from the spiritual core, from the spiritual source, are what we're supposed to relate to. We are the people that is the people of Hashem's oneness. We relate to Him directly. We have the chutzpah to go straight to the boss. That's what we are. That's what we're supposed to have. That's the good kind of chutzpah. Right? When a Jew is the kind of person, when he goes to the department store, he wants to go see the owner and ask him for a discount. Right? Personally. He's not interested in the step behind the counter. Is that right? That's what a Jew is supposed to be. Speak to the boss. That's the kosher kind of chutzpah. That's what we're supposed to have. That's our relationship with Hashem. That's how we were born. We were born from that dimension. Jews have given their lives for every detail of this dimension. They've been tortured to death, men, women, and little children, for every detail, for centuries, millions of us, for living only for Hashem at the source. The worst prohibition in the world, one of three things that you have to give your life for, is this idolatry thing. Where instead of relating to the source, you relate to valid channels that are 100% correct and accurate. They are called other gods because they are the channels. They really are there. But that is denying the source, and it's relating to an intermediary. The Chazal say that it happens everywhere, even in a bad way. When Hashem punishes us, what happens is we're supposed to see it as coming from Him. But we don't do that. If Hashem sends people to make a war in the Middle East and threaten us, a Jew is supposed to say, why is Hashem doing this to us? But if people start saying that the Arabs this and the Americans that, so the Chazal say it's like a man hits a dog with a stick and the dog starts biting the stick. You follow? The dog doesn't understand that, like that. There's a man that's doing this. They start biting the stick. A man throws a stone at the dog starts biting the stone. You follow? The whole world is agencies. It's just channels of agencies that reach us. But you've got to see beyond that and go to the source where it's all coming from. That's what we're supposed to do. That's the reason and that's the logic. The tragedy of it and the terror of it, the punishment of it, is that if you don't do that, it's not that you're putting yourself into some false system. On the contrary, you're putting yourself into a true system. And what then happens is you become subject to those forces. And if you read the forces that way and you accept that it is that way, then what happens is there's no way you can get out of it. And you become subject to those forces. And therefore, if a person's curious and they want to know what the future is going to be, and they're worried about something, and they think that there are people who can help them, and even if there is somebody who's qualified, which I doubt, but even if there is somebody who's qualified that you happen to know, you dare not go to that person, because if they are correct and they say a certain thing and you just give it any credibility, your punishment is that that's where you want to relate to, that's what relates to you. You want to come to me directly and lift yourself above the system and the situation, I'll take care of you. That's 100% promise. And when the result you get out of a moon is exactly how much you put into it. You have to be great enough to do it, but that's your challenge. But if you don't, that's what happens. I just want to say one thing. Halakhically it says that if someone tells a person an astrological prediction that he didn't ask for, you're allowed to believe it. Okay? Do you follow me? If somebody valid will come up to you and say, I happen to be an astrologer, I'm just theoretically, and I can see that this and this is going to happen to you, you're allowed to give it credibility. Well, why shouldn't you? But then you better do something to change it. Then you better start relating to the source in such a way that this thing will manifest in another way. You're not forced to disbelieve something that may be accurate, but you're not allowed to seek it out. Because then seeking it out means that you're giving it validity and credibility. And that you're definitely not allowed to do it in Israel of the Torah. Let's leave it there for today. Do you have any questions? Understand your question. The answer is as follows. I'll just say a short the answer. You have to think about it. The answer is that the highest level of your neshama is your free will. The definition of your neshama being above all the malachim, above all the angels, Rebbe Shachan says, is that the element where you relate, where you're exactly like Hashem, as it were, in image, is your free will to do whatever you want. Which means that you ask anything until you decide how to make yourself. If you decide to make yourself in the system below the level, that's what you are. Absolutely, sure. You can't ever affect the source of the neshama. But the anhugga, the way the world will play itself out relating to your practical existence, you can change totally. Definitely. Absolutely, sure. Neshama should have started with Zahari, that inner nekuda will always remain pure. That can never be changed. And it will always clarify itself in the end. But how the world relates to you now? Absolutely. And there's no limit to it. If you put yourself into the higher world and higher, there's no limit at all. You can achieve the most miraculous and wondrous things. You have to do it seriously, you know, just by wishing it. You have to work on yourself to a level that you really, really get there. But if you do, there's no limit at all. You want to smash it down and put yourself down here, that's exactly where you are.
It's like this.
Yeah, but it's like this. Those worlds, each world gives something that ends up here. All the threads are drawn together in you over here. But the threads that end up making up you, that bundle of threads, they all go all the way to the root. If you open it up to the higher source, that's where you, then it glows this way, you follow? It glows this way according to how high you let it happen. So you can emanate, you can manifest a much higher light. There's no question that you end up here. The fact that your root is up there, like I'm saying all the time, is no question, but where you are is right here. The question is how much of that light you bring with you. You want to behave like an animal, so then you manifest like an animal over here. You can do that very easily. You want to behave like a transcendent being and glow, you can do that too. You've got a machine here that's able to draw down the energy from wherever you choose to let it. And your obligation is to make it that machine glow with that level. Definitely. Yes.
So you
said
the set of rules that were given to us are not
I don't follow you.
The
rules.
We're given a set of rules
to live by. Right. Rules to live? No. What's not for the Jew? No. The system of nature. Okay, what looks like what's going to happen to you according to the forces of nature.
Versus
the rules of Torah? Which system? Torah or the nature? Or nature? Nature. Nature. The rules of nature. Absolutely. They're here to keep you and the world functioning. Absolutely, you must. So that you have a stage to play out your life on. I said that the answer to your question is as follows: the obligation of a Jew is not to transcend this world. The obligation of a Jew is to make this world, every aspect of your physical existence and this world, connect to the soul, so that you all transcend and manifest. The only way I can put it to you is like this: hear this well now. The mystics say that the non-Jewish soul, this might make it easier, okay? And the Jewish soul have got different pathways in spirituality. If a non-Jew wants to achieve spirituality, they must leave this world entirely and get up there. Leave it behind and get up there. Transcend completely. And by the way, they know that. That's why they become celibate and they don't get married. You have the people who really just live. No alcohol, no connection with the physical. Totally. Where do you get the thing of not marrying and having a family? I'm not saying that. But there's a certain element, of perception in it, that in order to get to spirituality, you have to leave behind the physical. The Jewish obligation is to get stuck into the physical and make it glow. That's why we get involved in marriage and wine. Think about it. We take wine. You know what wine is? Wine is so physical that if you have enough of it, you become part of the scenery. That's what it is. It makes you part of the physical world. And it's exactly that we take every time we want to transcend. We get married, we have a cup of wine. A bris, which takes the body and makes it spiritual, we have wine. Shabbos, where the week becomes Shabbos, which is transcendent, you follow what we're doing? We're saying that this agent that takes the human consciousness and makes him an animal, that's exactly what we're taking and lifting into the spiritual world. It's an incredible pathway. That's the path of the Jews. Not to leave it behind, to take it with you. Take marriage and the physical sensual side of it and lift it into Kedusha. That's an incredible pathway. Yes, sir. We have to stop. I don't want to. You have to have breakfast, ladies. Yeah.
We've got nature rules, but if you have enough emuna, those rules of nature can not be natural.
Absolutely. Sure. Yeah.
But Abraham not criticized for that.
Yes. No, Sarah was criticized.
But if they saw the whole mystical thing and natural.
They didn't laugh in disbelief. They didn't laugh in disbelief. It was a pure spiritual laughter. It was a laughter of perceiving how what looks natural actually is irrelevant. She was criticized because it says she didn't laugh enough in some places. She wasn't on that level of immunity.
Yes.
Can we leave that for another time to mind? It's a whole discussion. It represents the dimension of evil. You go and look in Bereshit about what tempted woman, so you'll see that's what it is. So yeah, yeah.
Okay. I'll show you. I'll put Jesus in the Western now.
Right. That's what it means. He showed him that the way you're reading doesn't have to be that way. He took him into the trance and rearranged it. Exactly. Yes. One more.
Well, can you talk about the regards to events that happen after the event? Does events
line? Absolutely. Yes, but that's a different... That is not as problematic. Let's just finish with this, okay? Last question. There's a question here about... Astrologically, there is... In fact, when... Once I was traveling with my Rebbe someplace, and he said to me, when's your birthday? And I said, today. He just looked at me and said, when's your birthday? And I said, today. He wanted to know when I was born. He had certain... The Gemara says if you're born under certain astrological influence, it fixes your personality 100%. Even which day of the week, the Gemara says clearly, child born definitely. So now, so what does that mean? What does it mean? But just briefly, the answer is like this. That isn't a problem at all, because the fact that you're born with a certain makeup, certain psychological, spiritual makeup, that isn't a destiny at all. That's only the tools that you've been given. Yes? Again, let's just understand. Look, slowly, one thing. Like, let's say you're born with a body that looks a certain way. Okay, your body. Why does your body look that way? Because when the spiritual forces condensed into a body, they came through an intermediate level, which is called the cosmic or the astrological level. And there already it was predicted. You could read it if you knew how. You could see what the child is going to look like. And when it's condensed, of course, it looked that way. Personality is no different. Your personality, whether you're quick to react or slow to react. Okay? You follow. Whether you're very intelligent or not very intelligent. Whether you have taste for certain things. Whether you're a violent type of individual or not. All sorts of things. That crystallizes into place through the same system. But that's not a problem. It's not a destiny. That's just a tool. That's not an event that's going to happen. That's just your tool. The question is, what are you going to do with it now? Your type is quick to react. Be careful not to get angry too quickly. And be careful to react quickly when somebody needs help. Use that thing correctly. Use that, what they call a tchuna. Use it correctly. The Gemara goes so far as to say, the Gemara asks a question like yours much stronger. The Gemara says, what about a person who's born under certain, where Mars is in a certain configuration? If the Gemara says clearly a child can be born bloodthirsty, Gemara says, isn't that a terrible disadvantage? The Gemara says, no, let him be a surgeon, or a moel, or a butcher, a shechet. You hear? Kedusha. So he's got that thing. Let him channel it, correct? Everybody. Okay.